How many times have offenders tried to kill you?
Under 10 times, but it's usually been...
Well, 10 times is a lot, I would say.
Sometimes it's been in the jails.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's in court. And when it's in court, it's the wildest thing of all, is because they leap over the table where they're sitting with their attorney, and they take a run at me.
And this has happened to you. So the defendant has leapt over the table and taken a run at you while you're in the box.
Yeah, screaming, you know, you mother effer, you know. And I'm sitting there like, okay, well, I better be ready. If they hit where I'm sitting, and these officers are slow, I'm going to have to defend myself.
Right. So, when was the last time this happened?
Not too long ago. It was only a few months ago. I sat in a room at Bellevue on a case, and at the end of the interview, this fellow takes a large dump in his jumpsuit,
mm-hmm.
declares out loud, "I think I just shit in my pants," reaches into his jumpsuit, pulls out a wad of shit on his hand, and for 4 or 5 seconds, they were the longest 4 or 5 seconds I had experienced in a long time, because I had no idea what the next move was. Was he going to throw it at me? Was he going to push it, you know, into my face? Was he going to push it onto my jacket or whatever? And his decision was to put his hand in his own mouth and eat the entire content of what was in his hand, and then made the declaration that it tasted like shit.
If that's not an endorsement for a career in forensic psychology, I don't know what is. If you've ever watched a true crime documentary and wondered who evaluates the people at the center of these cases, today's guest has spent more than 3 decades doing exactly that. Dr. N.G. Barrell is a forensic psychologist who has assessed violent offenders, consulted on high-profile criminal cases, and taught the next generation of forensic psychologists at John Jay College. Today, we're talking about what the job is really like and what it takes to become a forensic psychologist. Dr. Barrell, we get a lot of people commenting, emailing us about the career path of forensic psychiatry, psychology. So first of all, you're a forensic psychologist, correct?
That's correct,
And how long have you been doing that, and what is the difference?
I'd say I've been doing this well over 35 years. And the difference between, I take it you mean a forensic psychologist and psychiatrist, is that, you know, both people, like a forensic psychiatrist starts out, you know, they go to medical school, they choose a residency in psychiatry, and for reasons that they can talk about, you know, that relate to their lives, they decide to drift into the area of forensic work. For a psychologist, typically, you know, you go to graduate school and obtain either a PhD or a PsyD. It's in general clinical psychology. And then it's the same thing, you know, some experience with some idea gets you to thinking about how to apply what it is you've learned as a psychologist about human behavior, psychopathology, to any question that comes up related to, I suppose, human behavior and the law. So in other words, most people think about forensics as being strictly related to criminal behavior, but it could also be civil cases. For example, you know, you go to court because somebody suffered a very serious traumatic brain injury as a consequence of some accident that might have occurred on the job, or maybe they were subject to police brutality and they were beaten to a pulp and suffered, you know, injuries that need to be assessed both psychologically and neuropsychologically, meaning, you know, how the brain is working and what deficits exist. So you might find yourself in court discussing, you know, issues related to a civil case. A lot of psychologists and psychiatrists wind up in family court assessing people for custody issues or family violence or child's.
So from a day-to-day sense, is that the job that you're called in by a court to assess an offender, a person, and then give your opinion on how that relates to the crime that is being discussed?
If you're working at a hospital that has a forensic unit or at an agency that has a forensic unit, you know, the courts may, in fact, or the jails may send people over to your clinic because they require assessment and treatment. I, on the other hand, after early in my career, I worked at a forensic hospital in D.C. in Maryland, where they had people who had been adjudicated not guilty by reason of insanity. So my early exposure were to people who were very sick, who had committed like a lot of serious crimes. Mm-hmm. I mean, serious. And then after moving to New York, I worked as director of the family court clinic in the Bronx for a period of time and learned about, I don't know, evaluating delinquents, doing neglect abuse evaluations at the judge's request in the courthouse. And beyond that, I opened a private practice. And really, for the mainstay of my career, I've been a private practitioner and established a practice called New York Forensic, where we take cases that come in from lawyers, the courts, and for at least 30 years, I maintained contracts with the U.S. government to evaluate sex offenders and people with psychiatric problems that are on probation or arrested and they're on pretrial status, and the court wants them examined before they go to trial to figure out what's going on. So there's a lot of different ways to do this. And of course, in private practice, you're doing treatment with a population of people that are tied into typically the criminal justice system. So a lot of my personal patients that I see are sex offenders quite often. Sometimes they're people who have suffered sexual abuse, you know, in childhood. And then the rest is doing evaluations. It could be in an office. It could be at a jail. It could be in New York at Bellevue Hospital. I have patients brought from the jails to the hospital to be evaluated.
When you're doing these evaluations, do you have, I'm trying to think back on my own experience. I went to college and graduate school for psychology and worked in pediatric mental health. And you know, when you start down that road, they teach you the different branches of psychology, psychoanalysis, Jungian psychology,
right,
et cetera,
right,
et cetera. Do you have a branch of psychology that you use to frame your evaluations, like psychoanalysis, for example?
Not evaluations per se. I try to get a sense of who it is I'm looking at and evaluating. So, for example, someone's committed a series of rapes, serial rapists, or someone's committed a murder.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my goal is, I'm going to use a fancy term, to phenomenologically understand the context by which this person developed into the person they became. And what were the triggers that resulted in this particular crime occurring? And then beyond that, what is their level of intellect, personal insight? What obvious symptoms exist that might explain the irrational behavior that seems to have occurred in connection to a crime? Sometimes I get to see videos of the crime, which is always interesting. And really wild to watch someone getting murdered, because where the murder takes place, there are video cameras, or where the sex offense occurs, there are video cameras. So it's not so much you know, adhering to a theoretic or philosophic construct about how human beings operate, I kind of would like to think I take a very pragmatic, empirically based approach to doing my evaluations, because I have to defend my opinion in court, and I have to be able to demonstrate that I've tied point A to point B to point C and have that be credible. Now, if I'm working therapeutically with someone who's committed these crimes, then I also, well, I'm kind of, I still say kind of pragmatic, but I am interested in sort of, as I said, developmentally and to some degree analytically, how did this person get to be who they are? I mean, it didn't happen magically. I mean,
that's the aspect that of these ultra-violent offenders, these sexual psychopaths, that fascinates me. Where did they come from? How did that stew get made? When you're facing one of these people, when you're sitting across as a clinician from a sexually violent offender, and they've provided you the video where you can see the offense, and so now you're going to talk to this person having had that, literally seen it, do you approach them sympathetically? Do you approach them non-judgmentally? How do you approach someone like that, knowing what, having seen what they've done?
I think it's a matter of, when you do this kind of work, it's a little bit about the way you're wired yourself. You know, it's kind of like, how does a surgeon perform surgery on an infant, you know, and sort of cut an infant open in order to do what they need to do? Like, people will say, how can you do this? Mm-hmm. And I've been asked many times over the course of my career, how do you sit with someone who's, you know, sexually abused little kids, or has committed violent rapes, or has committed murder? You've seen the video of the murder, and I can't explain to you exactly why it's never been repulsive to me. It's been more interesting than repulsive. So I've gotten a chance to see some terrible things, really terrible. But I'm more curious to learn about, A, what this person thinks about the crime itself and how they got to be where they're at. A lot of times I don't initially share with the person I'm interviewing that I've seen the video.
You allow them to kind of assume your ignorance in the crime.
I want them to assume my ignorance, right, and tell me what the whole story is, so that I can circle back and later on ask them, or tell them, you know, well, now it's time to share with you that I've actually seen the videotape made, and now we have a lot to talk about above and beyond the crime, but why is it that you thought it was a good idea to tell stories about what it is you did when you were captured on video, and you know that?
And what's their reaction when you do this?
They get upset. They get upset, absolutely. Because, you know, they want to turn around and suggest that you're messing with them. Mm-hmm. And my response to that is, no one's messing with you. You killed someone. It's on video. It's clear that you're the person. The question becomes, who are you? You know, don't worry about who I am. Worry about who you are.
Yeah.
And what brought you to that place? Why in cold blood did you murder your girlfriend in a store when there's a video camera running, having, you know, sort of fleed from the apartment, and he's chasing you with a knife and goes into the store and starts to cut you up, you know? And why are you telling me a story that never occurred? And you know it never occurred. So why are we to have any faith in what it is you have to say about your motivation for doing what you've done? So it becomes an interesting exchange. And I kind of enjoy that as well. You know, it's kind of,
yeah,
you
know, that kind of, I don't know, cat and mouse maybe is the wrong word, but that.
It's a give and take. And it's a kind of like, it's not so much a gotcha, but it's kind of like, you know, you quickly revealed yourself to be a liar and someone who's not prepared to be forthcoming and clear about what's occurred. So let's talk about how you got to be this guy, you know?
When you're talking to someone, you know, I'm thinking of like a Joel Rifkin or someone like that who you've interviewed, who is a psychopath, who maybe doesn't have the level of insight into themselves or their crimes, and you get past that and you call them out in this kind of method that you're describing. Do you ever get to a point where they almost are appreciative? I'm thinking like they respect you for cutting through the bullshit, for deceiving them in a way, and then you know, realize that you're someone that they could talk to.
Well, some do and some don't. You know, it depends on how bright they are and how insightful they are, particularly predatory. I use the term psychopath. If they're bright and they're psychopathic, you know, then they want to play a little bit of a game with you. I had this guy that committed murder not too long ago. I happen to be Cuban. I'm from Cuba. I was born in Cuba and grew up in the United States. So a lot of times I get cases with people from Latin America or from the Caribbean. And so that's helpful for the courts and helpful for the lawyers that I can go in and talk to them. But this one guy was a white American who committed a brutal murder of his girlfriend. And he was really a disturbed personality. He was not psychiatrically disturbed in the sense of schizophrenia. He committed a really brutal murder. It was really something to see. And he showed no concern about her safety or welfare, or even after the fact, a kind of recoiled horror about what did I do or anything like that. But what was interesting is he wanted to engage in a little bit of a contest with me to quiz me as to my credentials.
Okay.
And I said, you get about a half hour and you can ask me whatever you want about my credentials. But after that, you know, that's the end. There's no more discussion. And, you know, and he wanted to know, like, oh, well, where did you go to school? And where did you wind up doing your doctoral studies? And what do you, and he would quiz me as to whether I had heard of someone so-and-so, or this author or that author. And I was kind of laughing because the arrogance was incredible. You know, this man had committed a cold-blooded murder, and he's quizzing me to determine whether or not, and my guess was because he was reading me as perhaps Latin or something, you know, he wanted to find out, you know, where I had gone to school and everything else. So, you know, the fact that I attended Yale and Columbia and, you know, Vanderbilt, I asked him if that was sufficient enough to proceed with a conversation with him about murdering his girlfriend, you know, or did I have to throw in some other schools or other education? And it still wasn't good enough because it became apparent that he wasn't going to discuss the murder. And I had to tell his lawyer, I've got some bad news for you. You're never going to get anything out of him. He's never going to talk about it. He's going to find a reason not to discuss this because he's a very special person. And very, very special people who commit murder are entitled to do that because, after all, his girlfriend must have pissed him off. And I figured, frankly, I said, let me ask you this. I don't know how much you know about your client, but was she trying to kick him out of the apartment and get rid of him because he was, you know, a menacing and a pain in the ass? And he said, I think that's what was going on. I said, that's my guess, is that she had had enough of him. But when you're a kind of a brazen narcissist who's so toxic that you're willing to commit murder, you know, no one kicks you out of an apartment and tells you that they've had enough of you. So the only solution is to kill them. You know, it's kind of wacky, you know, but it's part it's part of this guy's personality, you know.
It makes me think of a comment that we get frequently from our community that because we spend so much time breaking down the psychopathic personality, people often comment, I know someone like this in my life, or I was married to someone like this, or sure. This is my mother, this is my father. You know, we get right. That comment a lot. How do you approach someone like that in your real life if you're not a clinician? If you do know someone with those kind of psychopathic personality traits, extreme narcissism, how do you approach someone like that in your real life?
Well, in my real life, I say you should be speaking to a shrink.
I'm more thinking for our audience, how do they approach people like that? Is there any advice you could give them?
Well, I mean, if they had that type of person in their life, what options do they have?
Yeah, or just how do you engage with a person like that? You know, if you're...
I try not to get that deeply involved, you know, and I say it sounds rough. It sounds potentially dangerous. And I think you have a couple of choices. And basically, one choice is to really, you have to speak to a good, solid therapist and get a handle on how you want to proceed. Or if you're really frightened, you have the option of going to court and getting an order of protection. And you can go that route and have someone kicked out of your house or have them barred from coming to your house. But the stakes are higher when you do that, because now you've alerted them to the fact that you put them on the radar, you know, in a family mm-hmm. court, criminal court. And the question would be, you know, it's an interesting thing. If someone is psychopathic, why do you think they'd adhere to or give a shit about an order of protection issued by the court? They're willing to kill people sometimes, or they're willing to mm-hmm. do terrible things. So that it's kind of like one of the fallacies of the efficacy of the court system is that someone who's potentially quite violent is going to like respect an order of protection. So that's why I warn them that, you know,
yeah.
it might be opening up a can of worms that is quite dangerous.
Yeah. I mean, I think that speaks to the fundamental problem of the justice system, that we don't know if it's for punishment or restitution or for rehabilitation. We can't establish that. The justice system doesn't know. We don't know. So it's a difficult problem. But exactly like you say, if you're going to give a psychopath a restraining order, I don't know why you would expect that to work. So maybe the takeaway is, if you know someone like this, if you're watching an episode of Unmarked and you're saying, you know, Joel Rifkin or Gary Ridgway is my husband, you should just get away, perhaps.
Well, yeah, you could run away. I do get phone calls sometimes from people who I know are mentally ill, and they're telling me a whole story about their landlord, you know, planting bugs in their house, or, you know, a video. Miniature cameras or something like that, and they follow them from house to house. And then I say to myself, well, they're definitely mentally ill. So mm-hmm. I try to shake them, but I want to do so nicely. So I say to them, listen, I think you should collect all your evidence and go to the local police station and bring that to them and see what they say.
Right.
I'm not a police officer, so I can't do anything about that. But if you're that much concerned that this person, this landlord, is spying on you, whatever, collect all your information, go to the police department, and see what happens. And good luck.
Yeah, that's good advice for sure.
Yeah,
that's
all. You know, I don't ever say you're crazy or anything. You know, look, there might be like a very minute chance that something is up there weird, not quite the way they're saying it, but, you know, so go to the police with it. You know, they make the mistake, many people do, that a forensic psychologist or psychiatrist is there at the crime scene with the police. You know, they play that out a lot, you know, and that's just bullshit. That's nonsense. You know, you're lucky if after the fact, you know, if there are photographs or video, or, you know, there is you know, physical forensic evidence that people want you to see. Mm-hmm. That's helpful in doing an evaluation, but people do have it in their head that somehow, you know, you were right behind the officers as they bashed down the door, and somehow it was your brilliant profiling that brought them to that house and got the door broken down, and you found them in the room with the 5,000 photographs of the person that they are mm-hmm. obsessed about. I mean, a lot of that's just fictitious.
Yeah. A lot of rewatching Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah. You know, along those lines, you mm-hmm. know, and students I've had have said that to me, you know, like, oh, you know, what you do is so exciting. And I'll say, yeah, try sitting on a wooden bench for 4 hours before they produce, you know, a defendant. And you see rats running in and out from underneath the radiator, you know, at the jail. and explain to me what's exciting about that, you know?
Yeah.
It's not that exciting.
So would you say is, you know, as we wrap up here, would you say it's a good career? Would you recommend people pursue forensic psychiatry, psychology?
You have to have the temperament.
Yeah.
You know, if you're thinking about it like a baby or a child or someone who wants excitement, you may be barking up the wrong tree, you know, maybe stick to watching movies. But if you are truly interested in sitting patiently and painstakingly willing to talk to people who have done the unthinkable, I mean, and by the way, a lot of times people you evaluate just do bullshit crimes. It's not that they're that interesting. You just have to figure out, oh yes, they're schizophrenic. They were off their medicine. That's why they threw a brick through a window. Mm-hmm. That's the crime. There you go. Fantastic. Yeah. But the fact is, you do. If you enjoy, you know, talking to people and you enjoy thinking about what makes people tick and why would they do things that are unthinkable, and you know how to kind of volley with them and play back and forth. And I don't mean in a disrespectful way. I mean in a way that, you know, allows you to sort of enter their frame of reference, their world. It can be interesting, and courts can always be interesting. I mean, testimony can be, you know, kind of a fascinating theater where you see so many people misbehaving, including the authorities, you know. Mm-hmm. You see people lying where you know they're lying, and they're prosecuting a case, or a defense attorney lying and saying things happened that you know didn't happen. People go cuckoo in court sometimes and leap over tables and take a run at the expert witness. You know, you got to be prepared for all that. And this is what I tell. Now, I'm not saying this in a sexist way, but I think I need to say it. I do say to people, call me up for advice. Mm-hmm. If you're a woman and you want to do this kind of work, you have got to be prepared if you're going to do criminal work that the initial response from the people you're talking to is going to be to sexualize the experience. You know, you're going to have to be prepared for that. And you're going to have to be able to.
I would almost think being a woman in the field would be a benefit because, you know, I'm thinking of, you know, the interrogation of, I'm thinking of this because I just recently watched it, the interrogation of Gary Ridgway, in which Mary O'Toole, the FBI profiler, is able to really crack through that shell and he opens up about everything.
Right.
Because she's a woman, you know, and there are, you know, the same thing. I remember the example happening with John Wayne Gacy and his attorney. And, you know, there are many examples where these kind of men who are fixated on sadistic violence against women almost they talk to women a little easier sometimes. I don't know.
Sometimes, possibly, but quite often, mm-hmm. you know, the first hurdle is getting over the sexualizing of the contact, because you have to right. understand they're in prison. Usually when you're seeing them, if it's a serious crime, surrounded by men, and if their crimes were sexually related homicides or serial rapes or anything like that, you know, they're going to view a woman interviewing them as an opportunity to flirt or to say something vulgar or say something offsetting.
Mm-hmm. Like test those boundaries.
Test the boundaries, you know, and I do warn young women who call me up. I said, you know, you got to be prepared to hear some stuff that might rattle you. It won't rattle you. Well, if you stick with it, you'll learn how to deal with it and it won't affect you. But at the beginning, it will.
You alluded to the idea that someone jumped across a table and tried to kill you. Have you had people?
Yeah, that's happened a few times.
Really? Yeah. How many times have offenders tried to kill you?
Offenders have tried to kill me or attack me.
Yeah.
Under 10 times, but it's usually been a couple
of
times.
Well, 10 times is a lot, yeah, I would say.
Sometimes it's been in the jails.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's in court. And when it's in court, it's the wildest thing of all, is because they leap over the table where they're sitting with their attorney and they take a run at me.
And this has happened to you. So the defendant has leapt over the table and taken a run at you while you're in the box.
Yeah, screaming, you know, you mother effer, you know, and I'm sitting there like, okay, well, I better be ready. If they hit where I'm sitting, and these officers are slow, I'm going to have to defend myself.
Right. So, when was the last time this happened?
Attacked. It's been a while, but. Mm-hmm. Not too long ago, it was only a few months ago, I sat in a room at Bellevue on a case, and at the end of the interview, this fellow takes a large dump in his jumpsuit,
mm-hmm.
declares out loud, "I think I just shit in my pants," reaches into his jumpsuit, pulls out a wad of shit on his hand, mm-hmm. and for 4 or 5 seconds, they were the longest 4 or 5 seconds I had experienced in a long time, because I had no idea what the next move was. Was he going to throw it at me? Was he going to push it, you know, into my face? Was he going to push it onto my jacket or whatever? And his decision was to put his hand in his own mouth and eat the entire content of what was in his hand, and then made the declaration that it tasted like shit.
If that's not an endorsement for a career in forensic psychology, I don't know what is.
I think that's a great commercial. I think that's enough to, especially for that and watching what you eat, you know, during the day. If you want to lose a little weight, go sit through that and then leave and say, gee, I'd love to have some lunch now. You know, that's not what happens. So that was wild. And I did say something absurd to him when he did this.
What did you say?
What were you expecting? Cotton candy?